The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So, Joe will be going first.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks, comrades. So we decided ahead of time that each of us is going to speak for about 10 minutes, and I hope Julian will ruthlessly keep us to that time, because this is one of the longer sessions of this conference, and we have 2 hours, so we actually want to have a shorter presentation from the front and a lot more sort of audience participation. And so, let's have a really robust discussion in the latter part of this talk. So, I want to thank everyone for the warm welcome, and I also want to in turn welcome any members of the DSA or any other socialist groups specifically to this conference. It's an exciting thing to see the resurgence of a socialist left in this country, and I hope we can have a comradely and rich debate and discussion throughout the weekend and moving forward together. And I look forward to that. So, I just wanted to start with a couple of disclaimers. So, first of all, there's a lot of talks this weekend about labor history, what's gone on in the past, and my comments today are going to presume a lot of sort of shared knowledge about that, about what's come in the past, how we got here, and a lot of the outstanding critiques of the American labor movement, of which there are many. And so because we each have about 10 minutes, I want to talk more today about what we can do rather than, you know, what the sort of outstanding problems are. I encourage people to go to those other talks. So I'm also going to specifically talk more, I think, about public sector unions as the sort of last bastion of the American labor movement. It's also something I'm more familiar with from my personal experience, and so a lot of what I'm going to say is more sort of skewed towards that. So if people are in private sector unions, I hope they can add to the discussion afterwards. So just to get started, deduct that from my time. In the last couple of weeks, the Trump Supreme Court handed down a ruling in Janus versus AFSCME Council 31, and so there's really not a better time for the U.S. labor movement to urgently figure out a response to its ongoing decline. It's going to have an enormous impact and a profoundly negative impact on American unions, which we can talk about. But so far as I see it, there's basically two options on the table this year, and this is not anything new that people have said. And some of the people in the room have contributed this sort of argument. I think it's a basic one that the left should get comfortable with making. The first is that the American labor movement, and specifically public sector unions, can continue with the ongoing managed decline and slow retreat that has been part of their collaboration strategies or partnership strategies, whatever you want to call it. There's different languages for different unions and different workplaces. But they've all relied on a sort of an attempt to play nice with management in order to avoid high stakes battles and avoid defeats. And over the last few decades, we can say pretty clearly, I think, that has just utterly failed as a strategy. There's not a single part where things have been, it's hard to find a rosy outlook, and I'll just say that, and the American labor movement. So that strategy looked like, in a lot of places, a reliance on elected officials from the Democratic Party, and that looked like the continued bargaining of substandard contracts, ongoing austerity, the complete hemorrhaging of organized workplace power. And since Janus has just come down against us, as people have been expecting for some years now, this strategy is likely to deliver even less in benefits and wage gains to union members moving forward, since the unions are going to have to pare back their services they offer due to the lost financial resources through the absence of charging representation fees to non-members. So I don't think that's a very promising path, and if you do think that, you're probably at the wrong conference. But we should talk about it in the discussion. The second path that I would say is that we should take a page from the red state teacher rebellions and start doing what we have to in order to make our cities and states completely ungovernable through job actions, slowdowns, coordinated sick days, and strikes. some more strikes, and then some even more strikes on top of that. So obviously, that's not just a single brush that we can paint with. Everyone in this room can't just go out and organize a strike tomorrow. I wish we could, but that's not where we're at. But that also assumes that conditions are going to be different in very different places, and it would be foolish to pretend otherwise. But I will say that, especially in the public sector, you can see the sort of similar attacks that are immediately identifiable to public sector union members, whether you're in a red state or a blue state. There's falling state funding, there's austerity, there's layoffs and attrition that speed up the pace of our work, rising healthcare costs, stagnant wages, I mean, you name it. This stuff exists everywhere. So, to get a sense of what Janus will look like for a lot of public sector unions, the union that I work for, when the ruling was announced, just lost 25% of its annual revenues for the coming year, and we're going to have to figure out how to make that work. There's an immediate shock that we're going to feel, and we're going to have to tighten our belts somehow. So that's going to mean, trimming our staff costs. It's going to mean doing less or trying to increase dues, whatever. We've got to figure it out. I want to come back to our sort of overarching strategy for moving forward, because it's related to what I'm going to say. Just as a quick question, can anyone tell me, so the Abood decision was the Supreme Court decision, Abood versus the Detroit School Board, that was just overturned by Janus. Can anyone tell me what year the Abood decision was issued? 1977. I raised that just to say, you got really close. So I raised that just to say that the ability of public sector unions to collect agency or representation fees from non-members is actually a pretty new phenomenon. This has not been around forever. Similarly with public sector unionism in general in this country, it's actually a relatively new thing, dating back to the 1960s and 1970s. So the question then, I think it makes sense for us to ask, is how did the labor movement win the right to collect agency fees in the first place, and how did they establish themselves with sort of formalized collective bargaining? How did they go from a tiny movement to what they are today or have been in years past? So if people are not familiar with this history, there's a ton of books in the Haymarket Room that are really outstanding. I really recommend Joe Byrne's book as an excellent introduction, called Reviving the Strikes About the Private Sector. Then he wrote a second one about public sector unionism called Strike Back. Yep. There's also histories about AFSCME, the AFT, others that you can take a look at. But they go through this history. In the early 1960s, most public sector unions were tiny minoritarian organizations that were typically connected to socialist groups, if we're being honest, that had no formal collective bargaining power at all. And they represented members in disciplinary meetings and generally by lobbying for pay increases, but they didn't actually have legally binding contracts. And so the Chicago Teachers Union back in the 1930s, it existed way before this, but by sort of regularly representing people, and then during the Great Depression getting rowdy and going and nearly rioting downtown was how they would actually fight for pay increases, right? There wasn't a sort of formal legal mechanism for collective bargaining. And that really changes by 1977, where not only is collective bargaining enabled in many places, but there's a sort of firmly entrenched, sort of powerful public sector union movement. Why did that change is my basic question, and I think that, again, the history is instructive. That changed because the emerging public sector union movement, led by unions like the AFT or AFSCME, the International Association of Firefighters, even the NEA, settled upon a strategy of waging illegal public sector strikes in city after city, state after state, with an intention to be as absolutely disruptive as possible to the normal operation of American cities. There's a lot more that went into it, obviously. I'm giving a shorthand 10-minute talk, but in order to force state legislatures to pass enabling legislation, people had to be disruptive. They actually had to go on strike and shut down major American cities. And it was actually the strikes that preceded collective bargaining. So that actually allowed, it actually forced state legislatures to respond by passing laws in different places that not only legalized collective bargaining, but actually set up the mechanisms to administer it. And the plan worked. So you went from a tiny, tiny movement in 1960, when the first major public sector strike happens in the New York City Department of Education, to 1977, 17 years later, an organization goes from a few thousand, literally to millions, This is what happened, and this is how the public sector union movement got built. So there's the UFT strike in 1960, and they used subsequent strikes that were also non-majority strikes to build up their forces to eventually win a union election to represent all K through 12 teachers in New York City. And it's actually when they replicate this strategy around the country in other major American cities, that competition with the National Education Association, the NEA, forces the NEA to become more than the small principal school administrator oriented organization into a national union that engages in collective bargaining. Over the span of 10 years, the organization shifts and completely redefines itself. We've all got problems we can talk about with these existing unions today, but we'll get into that, but that is actually what happened. What's that? Jesus. The firefighters use sick outs and strikes to force local cities and counties to bargain contracts with them, and state legislatures eventually to enact laws. By the late 1960s, AFSCME claimed a membership growth of 1,000 new members a week because of signing up people on organizing drives, waging strikes from Everett, Washington to Memphis, Tennessee to Baltimore, Maryland, all over the place. The Transport Workers Union in New York City goes on strike in the first week or two that Mayor John Lindsay goes into office for 12 straight days. They win a 15 to 25% wage increases and set a pattern of workplace militancy for other public sector unions in the city. There's more to talk about there. This militancy, we should note, is also fed in part by the political upheavals of the 1960s and 70s, where many people who were involved in the civil rights movement, the black power movement, women's liberation, anti-war organizing, used their political, let alone the socialist left, used their political training and organizing to build new unions, and they did in mass numbers. And so that strategy of mass union organizing and disruption was what actually led to the passage of collective bargaining in the first place, not the other way around. You'll hear a lot of people in the labor movement today talk about, oh, we can't do anything unless the law changes. We have to change the laws to make things easier so that we can do it. It's actually not how it worked the first time, either in the private sector in the 1930s or in the public sector in the 1960s. Yeah, all right, sorry, I'll just move towards wrapping up. So here we are today. We're in a period of employer and government attacks on unions from the local level all the way up to the White House with Trump's Supreme Court and his recent attacks on federal workers. And this is now occurring in a potentially explosive mixture of historically low unemployment, a tightening labor market that's putting pressure on employers to raise wages in some sectors, and a turbulent political atmosphere that has normalized protest as a legitimate form of expression. So the New York Times did this study recently, and I think they found that more Americans attended protests in the first year of the Trump administration than any year previous in in American history, including in the 1960s. So that's a pretty incredible thing. And if we want to rebuild fighting unions from below, we should soberly take stock of where we're at and then begin taking practical steps to do what we can to recreate that mass disruption of previous decades. I really don't think there's any other way around it. If our unions want to survive the Trump era, we're going to have to experiment with more militant tactics and generalize what works. And I'm really happy that we have some West Virginia strikers in the House today. So. It's not going to happen overnight, but over a period of years. There's really probably not anything we can do today or tomorrow that's going to reverse the Janus ruling of the Supreme Court. The die has been cast already, but the point is that it was the active intervention of hundreds of thousands of regular working class people through organized, intentional disruption that is what built many of our unions in the first place, and this organized disruption is about the only hope of rebuilding them again. So far in 2018, more workers have gone on strike through these red state rebellions and elsewhere than at any time in American history since 1989, so that's we haven't seen strike activity like this in 30 years, and that's a significant thing. So that to me signals that we as the left should pay attention and see what we can do to generalize that wherever possible. It also signals to me that now would be a time for big thinking and some bold action. So obviously we're at a socialism conference. Socialists have an obvious role to play in this as the political and union militants who look to the working class as the agent of revolutionary change. And just as socialists have played an outsized role in the beginnings of the industrial union movement in the 30s or the public sector union movement in the 60s, we can play an outsized role today. So I would just finish by saying that I think that any socialist worth their salt should be thinking right now about how to intervene in the strikes that do occur, how to agitate and organize for strikes in our own workplaces, if there's a realistic basis for doing so, how to build public support and solidarity committees for the strikes that do occur to help them win, which strengthens our side every time we win, and how best we can work to heal that historic breach that's been opened up between the socialist movement and the union movement in the days of McCarthyism. So the world is changing and it's posing new questions for us, and we had better strive to answer them. I look forward to that.
My laptop, of course, does not work unless it's charging, so I'm going to do this off my phone. First off, I want to build off what Joe just said and say, like, you know, I recognize faces that have led some of these recent strikes, and I think it's like a, you know, it's a massive honor to be in the same room with these, with every one of you, and I think, you know, I'm thrilled that this is standing room only. So to build, again, from something Joe said towards the end, around, you know, 2018 has seen more people involved in being on the streets, being on strike, than we've seen in a really long time. And I'm going to give a, you know, he gave this broad brush view, I'm going to give a bit of a case study about what it looks like when social movements and unions actually start collaborating together in the contemporary moment. So I'm going to talk about the Me Too movement, and later. So there's sort of two overarching points here. So first of all, you know, as Joe said, we all know the complicated history of unions today and who's leading them, and there's real critiques there, and again, echo that everyone should go to those other talks about that. If we do want to do what I think a lot of us in this room want to do, which is actually revitalize the labor movement, which we need to do now more than ever post-Janus, certainly with Trump in office, we're going to have to look to what is seen as maybe non-traditional, not bread and butter, you know, issues around sexual harassment, around racial discrimination, around the separation of families. If we really want to use the energy to rebuild a fighting labor movement. On the other side of that, there's an argument to be made around the relevance of unions and organized labor to broader social movements. So to give a little quick history, I'm not going to explain what the Me Too movement is. I think everybody in this room probably knows about it. But the timeline is interesting. So in October, there's this investigation at the New York Times around Harvey Weinstein. What is seen as just one more investigative article becomes a spark that apparently, you know, for reasons that would take an entire another talk to give, really ignites a feminist rage in this country and around the world. I remember speaking to one of the authors of that investigation who is in my union in the News Guild, and she was shocked. She was, you know, she had no idea that anyone would care about this story, and God, was she wrong. So, you know, it's great when energy emerges that some of us in this room, I think, didn't see coming in advance. So the story itself obviously was about oppression, was about patriarchy, but it was also about work, glaringly, which is, you know, incredibly important. And I think a lot of people, when we first saw these stories coming out, sort of dismissed that. Because these were, you know, the stories that get on the front pages are about powerful men, and most of us experience sexual harassment or sexual assault by, you know, men that no one wants to write a story about because they don't matter, right? So in itself, you know, it's a great case study in that it also is about the failure of unions to actually protect rank and file members. So many of the victims of that first story were members of SAG-AFTRA, the actors' union that should have been representing and actually protecting and helping the victims of Harvey Weinstein actually, you know, stay safe and also get some justice out of it. And rank and file members, as soon as that story broke, started writing about what the policies the union had had in place around this and how completely outdated they were, right? Because a lot of unions, again, are very resistant to this idea of taking on social issues, right? Beyond the bread and butter, wages, bargaining, benefits, maybe healthcare, maybe not. In that sense, you know, what we saw after it was more of that, if you're keeping an eye out, about the relationship between an issue like sexual harassment and organized labor. So rather than making the news for, say, having innovative policies around this stuff, actually unions wound up in the headlines as homes to sexual harassment and sexual assault. So there's one case of SEIU ending up, you know, this was not long after the Harvey Weinstein story came out, that SEIU got in the headlines because one of the architects of the Fight for 15 campaign had actually been not only sexually harassing people, but also had created a systematized sort of system of people who were on staff either willing to put up with sexual harassment or doing it themselves. And the irony here, of course, I think that it should infuriate everyone in the room, is that, of course, the Fight for 15 is representing, in theory, low-wage workers, overwhelmingly women, who report, the majority of them report sexual harassment in the workplace. So again, this was a mobilizing issue that actually could have gotten a lot of new members into this campaign who were, would have been affected by this, would have been moved to actually get energized and revitalize their existing relationship with something like SEIU, who, of course, that opportunity was largely missed thanks to the failure of organizations like SEIU. On the alternative side of things, right here in Chicago, Unite Here Local 1 used the moment around Harvey Weinstein to actually push at the city council level an ordinance that would require all hotel workers, who many of whom were members of that local, to have panic buttons. So it was a workplace safety issue. They deal, of course, the majority report that they have dealt with sexual harassment in hotels like this one, by guests, by colleagues, whatever. And so it was a case where, even as I saw, you know, certain people even on the left kind of dismissing the significance of the Me Too movement as this sort of bourgeois privileged issue of women, you actually saw working class organizations that were led by women making use of the moment, as we always should and we always do, right? So, I mean, and of course the irony here was this letter that got all this attention by domestic, by farm workers, about 70,000 of them had, you know, their organization had signed a letter in solidarity with the women in Hollywood, which, you know, again, shows you that never dismiss how serious working class women are about using any moment we can to actually get some power here. And so I think that was a incredibly important, inspiring kind of situation of the, you know, this moment we're in, where unions are, as we all agree, I think, in this room, you know, kind of the best vehicle we have right now. They're flawed, they're imperfect, often their leadership is on the wrong side of things. We've seen that in this story, that the leadership was never ahead of this when it came to sexual harassment. And they were always being pushed by the rank and file. And I'm looking at one of the West Virginia teachers because, I mean, again, we talk about the relevance of something that is seen as a non-traditional issue. I mean, the teacher strikes were led by women, overwhelmingly, right? And these were women who were coming hot off the heels of the Me Too movement and actually had gotten used to talking about workplace issues. And all of a sudden they realized, oh, right, I actually can be a leader in the workplace. I actually do have, there's a relevance here for organized labor and me. This is not an alien institution that is providing services to me. This is actually my union. So fortunately, I'm actually almost to the end. So I want to end by saying the relevance for us in this room of this idea of a case study around something that might be seen as, you know, non-traditional for a union concern, sexual harassment, pervasive, oh my God, impossible, we can't overcome it, we can't contract, a lot of times we can't bargain in a contract around this. Actually, we can, and we've seen it. In my industry, in my union, I've been, you know, as a really small example, because obviously I'm in the media industry, and these stories were really hot in media themselves. There were all these issues around various bosses of ours perpetuating this discrimination within our own workplaces. I've actually seen it lead to both unionization campaigns. That's been at the center of a lot of union drives within media. It certainly is in the center of a lot of other drives. I helped organize a union at Northeastern University where the central issue was that people were dealing with sexual harassment and that the union actually would be a way for us to have protection to really take this up to the bosses and have a say beyond trying to deal with this individually with your own advisor, which, you know, is completely impossible. So I've seen it. I can speak to the fact that this is exactly the kind of issue that when we see mass energy, we saw millions in the streets around the Women's March, we saw every person you ever knew from high school talking about Me Too. You know, all of a sudden, there's no reason for us to shy away from the reality that actually this is, these things have a lot in common, rebuilding labor, and actually speaking to this vast outrage that we've seen now that Trump's been elected and it's been kicked into high gear. So I just wanna end by saying that sexual harassment, feminist issues, whatever you wanna call it, is not the only example of this, right? We've seen this, I mean, there are members of the ISO who've led, and DSA as well, who've led, for example, making their unions sanctuary unions, right? So there's energy around abolishing ICE, thank God. There's energy around ending family separation, and then we see that energy actually being funneled to talk about how, what is rank and file organizing around these issues look like to strengthen our own unions. We see it again with whether it was the anti-police brutality movement, whether it's about healthcare, and actually a number of unions, including, you know, a lot of the nurses' unions, have been at the forefront of saying, this is not just a social issue. We've actually built a private welfare state for our members, and it not only doesn't benefit their communities, but actually we have to bargain over this, and it takes forever. Let's win universal health care. Mm-hmm. Let's support that demand. Let's help everybody and have a lot more time to talk about other issues, right? So I think this is just like one important case study, but I think we really need to start thinking a lot more expansively about the relationship between whatever is going on in the world and actually how we connect this into our own workplaces. And I think we actually, it doesn't, you know, to Joe's point, socialists who actually have this understanding of why the working class is so particularly powerful for achieving any of these demands we have, whether it's around gender inequality, whether it's around any kind of oppression, whether it's about ending ICE, actually unions are our strongest vehicles for that, right? So I think we should be playing a leading role, and we can, in making those connections and actually using that energy. So, thanks.
Okay, healthcare unions and Janice in 10 minutes. Let's go. So, you know, first I think to take a little bit of a step back to answer this question, we have to start with the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, I think produced the current moment and the current dynamic that is influencing and has provided a resurgence of a healthcare justice movement in this country. And the reason for that is, by and large, it was a piece of legislation and a reform that was, you could maybe say, one step forward and five or six steps back, which is contrary to the popular narrative around that legislation. While it increased and expanded Medicaid for a whole number of people, which is a critical thing, and increased regulations on the insurance companies and allowed some people to get access to a private insurance plan that wouldn't have before, it at the same time profoundly decreased the funding to Medicare. It eliminated funding for hospitals that take care of the uninsured, and it was designed to squeezed community hospitals and public hospitals' finances to the point where they're in a mortal crisis, and many of them have closed and have decreased services. It also increased corporate subsidies and failed to decrease healthcare costs, increasing out-of-pocket expenses, and produced the moment that we saw leading up to the elections in 2016. So what it did was, overall, increase coverage for many people, but decreased access to care, and increased the power of the private insurance companies through massive government subsidies towards that industry. And then it also decreased the quality of healthcare delivery in a number of different ways, and some other people can hopefully speak to more of those dynamics in the discussion. But producing that moment with the elections, where you have, you know, on the one hand Bernie and on the other hand Trump, healthcare, the issue of healthcare exemplified, I believe, the polarization that we saw in places in U.S. society, and also it also exemplified where you also saw overlap within that polarization. So you could have somebody who was a Bernie supporter in the primaries then go on to vote for Trump in the general elections. You could have somebody who was against the Affordable Care Act, maybe even from a right-wing perspective or buying a right-wing narrative, and voted for Trump on that basis, but was also open to Medicare for all. And it's because the Affordable Care Act actually did have this net effect of decreasing people's experience of healthcare in this country, and allowed for Trump to use that as a key element to why the working people should kick the bums out. In this case, the bum was Obama. And not to downplay the virulent racism and virulent nasty scapegoating that was involved in the Trump campaign, but a lot of Trump's narratives that didn't make the media were actually about more bread and butter issues in a lot of places like West Virginia and other around these questions of healthcare and jobs and so on and so forth, and that's what sold it for a lot of people. But so unions' relationship to the Affordable Care Act was almost universally supportive of the Affordable Care Act. There's exceptions like National Nurses United and my union and United Electrical Workers. Others, a number of unions are on paper supporting Medicare for All, but have ultimately failed to actually support the movement in any concrete and serious way, whether that be nationally or in any of its local iterations. Switching gears a little bit, the current movement for Medicare for All that we've seen an amazing and significant increase in the popularity of over the last couple years, I think has its roots in recent history, one with the release of the movie Sicko, which was a documentary by Michael Moore, which actually saw an expansive resurgence of the popularity, and there was activism, and a number of coalitions sprang up to project the project of single payer and Medicare for All organizing. Within the Affordable Care Act debate, there was insertion of activists trying to make single payer part of that debate. They were completely shut down by the full weight of the Democratic Party at the time, physically and rhetorically. And then that sort of set the stage for, I think, with the success of Bernie's campaign and the growth of the Democratic Socialist America, and both of those related groupings actually making Medicare for All an important priority, and has provided the context for a broader popularity of that idea. And then that kind of dovetailed into the movement when Trump decided to try to repeal some of the best aspects of the Affordable Care Act while keeping some of the worst aspects of the Affordable Care Act in terms of his move for Trump Care. And there was an interesting moment where many of the liberal groupings, Democratic Party connected groupings, were mobilizing to defend the Affordable Care Act, but also single payer Medicare for All forces were also mobilizing to defend this particular attack on healthcare. What came out at the end of it was an increase in energy and popularity of Medicare for All. Settling for the status quo. And it's because the issue of publicly guaranteed services, Medicaid and Medicare, which were particularly the ones under attack by Trump, was renewed as a conversation, was renewed as something to defend and something that's necessary. And so single payer activists were there to take advantage of that and strengthen their forces to a certain degree in that moment, which I believe was last summer, if I'm not mistaken. So unfortunately, in the wake of that, there has been no significant change in the increase in official union support for single payer in the wake of that. Fortunately, the opportunities among union members and among the population as a whole to build a movement that is based on healthcare justice and Medicare for All has increased. So there's that tension that exists. The need for the union movement to not only participate in leading the case for Medicare for All is of absolute utmost importance, both for the success of the Medicare for All project, but also for the success of the labor movement itself, and for and especially in the wake of Janus and the future of collective bargaining. Just a quick anecdote about the situation of public sector union healthcare bargaining right now. I'm a member of the public sector nurses in New York City. We are part of a 250,000 public sector workers that are subject to a pattern agreement and a common healthcare plan. And just last week, the initial agreement was agreed upon by all the city unions that they will once again give back $1.1 billion from their healthcare fund in the terms of savings to the city in order to pay for pretty paltry raises, 2.5% and 3%. The city has only budgeted 1% increases for public sector workers, and this is, you know, the Working Families Party darling Bill de Blasio who is implementing this this austerity. So, and that was on back of the previous contract settlement, which gave $1.2 billion in healthcare savings in order to pay for those raises and retroactive payments of wage increases. So, you know, Janus plus the Affordable Care Act. In the context of the overall business class offensive against unions and working people, necessitate more bold and radical solutions to the range of problems that exist in the union movement. Most of the official labor movement, unfortunately, though, is tying both of its hands behind its back around the question of Medicare for all, and they're doing it for a number of partially understandable reasons, but also very short-sighted ones. One is that it's rooted in a general defensive posture and an approach that's attempted to try and sell their existence as a union as a package of benefits to people. So if Medicare for all is, you know, implemented, then it's not something that, you know, the union can say, stick around, you'll get, you know, you'll work fighting for better benefits, etc. It also, probably more importantly, is relying on, in terms of defending themselves against Janus, it's relying on political relationships within the Democratic Party in order to carve out protection measures that will help them slow down the hemorrhage of members, which then in turn means that they have to follow the Democrats' lead on whether or not they can support or be active in the Medicare for All movement. And although that is changing, at least rhetorically to some degree, it is far from something that the Democratic Party wants to actually see happen. It's also rooted in a fear that Medicare for All would be worse for union members who have decent health care coverage, or that the perception of Medicare for All being worse for union members with good health care coverage, and they don't want to take the risk that being in support of this would damage their reputation among their membership in terms of the quality of the benefits that they currently have. I'm at 10. Okay, I'll wrap up. So. All of this, you know, with few exceptions, they're just not looking for grassroots shop floor mobilization in a post-Janus world. And unfortunately, in terms of the national strategies around Medicare for All, there was a lot of hope recently in the last several months that National Nurses United was putting a few million dollars into a national campaign for Medicare for All. I've just learned in the last week that is now off the table, and that they are going to a more localized strategy, and that they're kind of pulling the plug on that more broad and bold plan. So all of this is to say that this necessitates a robust rank and file strategy for rebuilding the labor movement and pushing unions to take up Medicare for All as a central demand. This also needs to be combined with a strategy among socialists of rebuilding a socialist current within the labor movement that can be the backbone of such a process in order to take these important shorter term fights into a much broader fight that ultimately confronts capitalism itself as the root cause of all of the situations that workers find themselves in, healthcare coverage, sexual harassment, and otherwise. And if you're looking for something to be hopeful about, I'd like Ms. Tristan to stand up and say a few words maybe, but just say, come July 12th, all eyes on Vermont, where the nurses will be going on strike, hopefully. To really show in practice what a real fight for healthcare justice can look like with the power of mostly women nurses and badass organizers.
Thank you. That was fantastic. So like I said, we're going to ask a couple questions to the panelists, and then we're going to give us at least 45 to an hour for discussion, for questions, for us to discuss these issues amongst each other, and to pose questions to the panelists if you'd like. So that was three great contributions, I think. I mean, it's, you know, the need to organize, sorry about that. The need to organize and agitate towards militant workplace action, the need to bring social movements into the workplace, and the importance of labor being able to shape the broader political discussions in this country, and perhaps even internationally, depending on what the topic is. So I guess a question for each of y'all is, like, what is, you know, we sort of touched on the role of socialist organization, but I'm wondering if you guys can talk a little bit about that, or some more. Do we think the socialist movement is well situated to take this work on? Or what should it do to prepare if we don't think so? Oh, look at that. I think there's a limit how far we go. We'll see.
Let's test that. Yeah. We're good at that.
Yeah. I'll just come
up,
whatever.
Oh, you made me pull it that far? Oh, look, it pulls further.
Does it work?
Yeah.
It okay, great. Yeah. And how many socialist organizers did it take to order that table?
Bigger stages for one.
Actually, do you want to go first?
sure.
Yeah.
After all that. So I'll speak a little bit to DSA in this, what DSA is doing around this. So again, the question is around, you know, how well situated are socialist organizations, and, you know, can they play a role? I think they absolutely can play a role, and we've seen it. I mean, radicals in West Virginia were, you know, it didn't take a whole lot for them to actually, you know, be the first to take their districts out on strike. And we've seen that, you know, in a number of other strikes recently as well. That said, you know, the socialist movement remains far smaller than it needs to be, right? And those of us who are in it and who are in socialist organizations and are also union members are also sadly so few in number. So I think there does have to be a real orientation around this stuff, around taking what we've seen is both the necessity, as Joe spoke to, of revitalizing labor right now, should, you know, so as to not take the other path, the first one he gave, of basically the death of labor. So socialists, I think, do need to really take that seriously. In DSA, you know, both there is an incredibly strong effort right now on to do exactly that. Not necessarily that's new to the labor or to the socialist movement writ large, right? Obviously, we have a whole history that would be a fun talk in itself about this attempt, you know, around the New Left to really concentrate. And I don't think that's necessarily quite the way to do things now. That said, you know, so I'm in NYC DSA, and we just passed a resolution around actually systematically not concentrating, but encouraging and informing members. I forget the exact language, but to pick strategic industries and actually talk about what it means to be in the labor movement for life and to really implement our politics in practice. So, you know, it depends on the situation of your organization. So in New York City, we actually have a huge number of union members and rank and file members of various unions who are in DSA, in our labor branch particularly. So we actually do have the capacity to do something like that, to both encourage newer members around the broader DSA organization to think about, well, you need a job anyway, we all have shit jobs, why not be a teacher? Why not be a nurse? And then to also give them the training and the understanding and the skills to get those jobs and to think about what it means to really commit to doing this work. And I think that's absolutely something that socialist organizations should be doing and really can start doing. And again, it doesn't take a whole lot of people to really, whether it's to unionize or start a strike or radicalize a workplace campaign. So absolutely, people in this room, I think, you know, could play a big role in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I find it hard to speak generally. I'll think I'll just sort of concretely relate what I think it looks like in my workplace, which is, I'm part of the public sector nurses in New York are about 9,000 in total. We're across 11 different major healthcare facilities and a number of different clinics. Currently, I would say that there's probably in the range of, 4 or 5 dozen, nurses who I would consider active in organizing their some aspects of their workplace out of that 9,000. And then I would say in terms of organized socialists, there's two. there's myself and a badass young DSA member at Harlem Hospital who's just coming off her probation. And we're working together, and we're in coordination with some other people in the union more broadly. But when I look at those situations and then you look at what it's going to take to organize a strike when our contract expires next year, I'm of the school that anything can happen, certainly. But I think that it's a real challenge to figure out what is it that we can play in terms of a subjective role going from here to there. I'll tell you what I have done as a socialist organizing my workplace up in preparing for Janus and in terms of preparing for this contract battle, which is to, on the one hand, help cohere, some of my closer coworkers, both who are closer to my politics politically, closer to socialist politics, but also who are starting to emerge as people who are interested in fighting around shop floor issues. The big issue in my hospital is twofold. It's actually the signature issue in almost all nursing is staffing. Is the profound and inhumane staffing conditions that exist for both nurses and the patients, and that is half worse true in the public hospital system, especially in places like in the emergency room. And so there's been some really significant fights that I've helped the old emergency room nurses organize around fighting for more staffing, and I've through that process have identified somebody who I think is a really dynamic new organizer, and I hope can be a part of organizing stuff in the future and hopefully even become part of the socialist movement in the short term. In my own department, we were faced with the closure or the elimination of our trauma status as a pediatric trauma center in the Bronx. We're the only pediatric trauma center in the Bronx. And the city system, because of budget cuts, wanted to eliminate that trauma status because it requires them to have resources that they do not want to devote. So about a year-long process, I helped organize a series of actions and different campaigns, petitions going to community boards, et cetera, bringing in nurses across the pediatric department. And thankfully, we actually won that fight. And that helped. That helped set the stage for what I hope to be a little bit higher expectations that people have going into this next contract battle, and hopefully can be some organizing touchstones for bringing a broader fight against what is going to be a shit deal that is going to try to get shoved down our throats by both the mayor and maybe even our own union. I am on the bargaining committee of this contract. I'm one of 10 people and 5 alternates on my bargaining committee for the whole city system. So that should be an interesting experience. So I think there's definitely opportunities and there's definitely questions. But I would I'd sort of say kind of how I did it in my talk, which is I think that the subjective factor of what's more important than whether or not we can actually ultimately strike in a year's time is how coherent that layer of radicals and union militants are in the short term and in the medium term around organizing around issues and connecting with our coworkers politically and raising those expectations.
I'm glad that you talked about you, Sean, because I was also going to talk about you as an example. I'm proud to call Sean my comrade here because I think his activity in his union is actually in some ways a model for what people can do even as lone socialists at their workplace. He's being especially modest right now, but his intervention within NYSA is one of the main reasons that the Bronx still has a pediatric trauma unit and people should be. Small thing, folks. It's really not, and I'm not saying that to be boastful. It's really not a small thing. So I guess my answer would be I think that the socialist left is well placed in some locations to intervene in these things, and I think there's great examples of that. And I think Alex has now been on two different new organizing committees that have been successful, which is pretty exciting. It's like there's obviously a role that socialists play in those situations, but there is still a sort of historic gap that we should be aware of, right? Like McCarthyism, and before that, the Red Scare in the 1920s. But McCarthyism really severed the historic organic link between the socialist political movement in this country and the organized workers' movement. And it's been a long time trying to heal that breach, and people have tried in different ways to do it, but it's one that still exists, and that's not anything people should feel guilty about or feel bad about, but it is something that does actually exist, and that is a sort of historic task that I think the socialist left in the United States should take up. And I think there's promising examples of that in recent years and promising developments in that direction. So I think that the socialist left should do what they can to heal that breach, and there's a couple ways to do that. So one is that if the socialists are in a workplace and there's no union, you can just organize a union. Like if things are bad enough, you're able to get your coworkers together. Obviously, look, I'm a union organizer. We fail more times than we win. I know it's really hard. There's a lot that goes into it. But there's some really exciting recent organizing victories that people can point to, and there's members of the audience that can talk about that. So that's one way to do it. If there's a separation between the organized left and the unions, you can start new unions, right? So that's an exciting thing. The other is to look where there's smoke and go and try and find the fire. And so I would say that, and it's worth taking a look and seeing what's actually going on in the economy, where struggles are taking place, and to try and relate to that. And you can do that from the outside, you can do that from the inside. There's different ways to do that, and maybe people would disagree about the specifics of that, but I think we should probably all agree that process of trying to heal that breach is one that is best done in an intelligent and a marshaled and a sympathetic, systematic way as well. And if we're actually going to heal that breach, it's got to be done intentionally and not just through waiting and hoping and praying or thinking that osmosis is gonna do that. We actually have to be intentional about where we put our forces, where we place our bets, and try to intervene in struggles as they occur. And that's the good news is that now there's struggle happening again. It's still a relatively small sample size given the history of the American left, but there are struggles that are breaking out. And so now this actually provides us with an opportunity to take a look at these dynamics and see one way or another. So.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.